From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, for Independence Day weekend, we're revisiting some of our favorite interviews from this summer. I'll find out about tigers at the zoo and quilts at the Indiana State Museum.
Well, I'll learn about the mummies, cannons, and terracotta warriors at the Children's Museum. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What do we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR.
The Indianapolis Zoo is playing its part in conservation in a big way on several fronts, including creating a new habitat for its three Emir tigers. The habitat, called Tiger Forest, recently opened to great acclaim, and Sharon Gamble had the chance to talk with Nora Fletchell, VP of Conservation for the zoo, about these tigers, why they're endangered, and what she learned about them on an extended research trip to Russia.
So before we talk about the cool research you got to do and your trip to Russia, can you describe the, and let me make sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, Emir tiger to us?
Well, the Emir tiger is actually the largest species of tiger found on the planet. There used to be eight species of subspecies of tigers in the world, and now we're down to five, unfortunately. With Emir tigers being the largest, the males can get up to 600 pounds, and the females are about half that size. So they really are the what we call the apex predators of the Russian Far East. They're the largest cat on the face of the earth.
They're still pretty fast, though, even though they're...
I wouldn't call them speedy like a cheetah, but what I would call them is very lithe and agile and very deliberate in their movement. They are a stealth hunter. They're not a chaser. They'll sit and wait for their prey to come by and then stalk them that way versus chasing them down.
So they're strategizing. They're not just running after.
Yes, strategizing is an excellent way to describe it. They are a very thoughtful, deliberate hunter.
I was surprised to learn that they can and do eat bears. I mean, that seems like a pretty big prey.
Yes, that was one of the things that I was surprised to learn when I did travel to Russia, was the fact that in this particular part of Russia where the Emir tiger lives, there are bear, and they do occasionally prey on bears.
What is their typical diet, though? What else will they eat?
Typically, they'll eat deer. There's a couple of different species of deer in that region, and wild boar is another big part of their diet.
Sounds kind of scary to chase down a wild boar.
Wild boar, actually, it's interesting. The researchers were telling me wild boar is actually probably even a little bit more dangerous for a tiger than, say, a bear. But tigers will eat anything from great big huge bears on down to mice, depending on what their needs are and what they can find.
They'll also eat domesticated animals. They'll eat pets if they're in the area, yeah?
Yeah, a dog to a tiger is another carnivore, and
sure,
therefore could be perceived as a threat. So the dogs that the people in Russia have as pets or as guard dogs are sometimes seen as a threat by tigers, and they will on occasion take dogs.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a significant issue, but it is something that they deal with, you know, on a fairly consistent basis.
So is that, let's talk about why tigers in general, but this breed in particular is endangered. People are hunting them for their beautiful pelts, yeah?
Well, there's basically two issues. One is the poaching or the illegal hunting, and the other one is just the thing that we face with all wildlife is the human-wildlife conflict. As the eastern part of Russia develops economically, what you're starting to see is more roads and more development taking place. And simply what that does is it just opens up the tiger's habitat to exposure to humans, thereby leading to, in some cases, conflict. Now, what happens when those roads are built, that facilitates humans coming in and doing things like establishing logging camps, which actually sometimes, if done right and legally in concert with the government, works quite effectively. But when it doesn't, or when it just exposes these tigers to humans, it opens up tigers to poaching, and a pelt of a tiger and tiger parts are still a large part of the black market for tigers. And so one poacher could make as much as $80,000 US, which is a huge amount of money in Russia or in China or, you know, other parts of Asia. And so that potential to gain that income is a huge incentive, unfortunately, for poaching.
And it's hard to just, it's not like you can communicate with the tigers and say, just move away from the region that the roads have just opened up in there. That can't be done.
Exactly, because these roads provide places for tigers to sit. Tigers like to watch and find prey, so roads are open spaces where prey will move through deer and other types of things. So the tigers tend to go to the roads because then it's easier for them to find prey. Then they're exposed, unfortunately, to humans. They're exposed occasionally to being hit by cars or trucks or those types of things as well. So it's one of those things where there's a very delicate balance there. And the researchers in Russia and the conservation biologists are working hard towards trying to maintain that balance.
Now, am I correct in assuming that it's not just the beautiful fur, but that there's some medicinal qualities perceived to be, the organs or what is used for medicine?
Virtually all parts of a tiger do have some significance in traditional Oriental medicine. And so, and it could be organs, it could be particular bones or those types of things that are seen particularly in China as having medicinal value. So that drives up the demand for those parts, those black market acquired parts. So unfortunately, it's something where you have to look at the culture that those people have been living in for thousands and thousands of years. That's a very valuable part of their culture. And so how do we work together to get them to understand that the negative impact that has on tigers in the wild, not just in eastern Russia, but throughout a tiger's range, which is pretty much everywhere from India on east through parts of Russia, through China, and Southeast Asia as well.
So in the process, we should say that the zoo is home to three tigers right now, and tell us where they came from and kind of how they interact with one another.
Well, right now we have three. We have one male and two females. Now, in the wild, tigers live completely solitary lives for the most part.
Really?
Except for mothers and their cubs. And then they'll come together, obviously, for breeding, one male and one female. So our male, Pecha, has been with us for a little while. He came to us from another zoo. And Andrea, our newest female, actually came to us just late last year from the St. Louis Zoo. And Sila, who is actually born here at the zoo, her linkage is very closely tied to a female who was imported into this country as an orphan back in the mid-1990s. So she's kind of the link to the past with our tigers at the Indianapolis Zoo. We have a very great staff, and we have a very, very capable staff, and we've been able to actually breed and produce cubs for several years here. And so those three tigers, what you'll typically see is the exhibit area is actually two exhibits. And so when you come, you may see one of the females in one of the exhibits and the other female and a male in the other exhibit. Adult female tigers don't get along so well. So you probably won't ever see the two females together, but we are hoping to be able to breed a couple of those animals. And so we hope in the future to be able to produce cubs to continue to have that very important tiger population in zoos, so we can really show people what they're like and help them to learn what the issues are and the challenges are with tiger conservation.
In the wild, does the father stay around after the cubs are born?
No, he'll move away. Their home range in the wild is huge. A typical tiger's home range, if you look at the 465 circle around Indianapolis, mm-hmm. a tiger's home range is about half of that.
Wow.
So one individual tiger would have about half of that circle.
It's a big hunting
territory. That's a huge hunting territory, and they need that because that's their prey base. Deer and boar have very large home ranges as well. So in order to support one tiger, you need that much land.
Sure. So how long does it take for the cub to reach maturity, and how does the mother, I know this is a kind of a naive question, but I don't live in the wild, so I have to ask it. How does the mother get food while she's nursing the cub? And, you know, obviously she's got to recover a little bit from giving birth.
Usually for the first few days, she'll stick pretty close by with the cubs. Tiger cubs, just like domestic cats, are born blind, and their ears, they can't hear anything for the first few weeks. And so they'll stay very close. They'll stay in the den. The dens that these tigers build are very secluded and very secretive. So she'll leave the cubs, and she'll go off and she'll hunt. And she'll gradually, as the cubs' eyes open and their ears open up, she'll gradually start to introduce meat into their diet while she's nursing. But she'll leave those cubs for brief periods of time to go off and hunt, and then she'll come back to them, not in any more than a few hours.
Sure.
Or something along those lines. But then as the cubs grow, she'll teach them to hunt. Very similar to what you might see if you have a cat or a kitten, and, you know, they're tearing up toys and, you know, stalking and that. Tigers learn from their mothers. They are taught how to hunt by their mothers. And so that's how they learn as well, through experiment and trial and error, just like your kitten learns how to catch mice at home.
Yeah. How long does it take before the cub is old enough to, is mature, basically?
Usually it's 18 months to 2 years.
Okay.
They'll move away, move off from their mother. Usually at around a year to 14 months, you'll start to see that separation.
And what's a typical litter? Is it just one or two cubs? Or is
It's typically anywhere from one. Four is very unusual. So you're talking about usually two to three is the average size, but one individual cub in the wild is not unusual.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
When you obviously you had tigers at the zoo before you went to Russia to try to get a little bit more information before the newly designed habitat. What were you expecting when you went to Russia, and what did you learn that might have challenged your expectations?
Well, I think before I went, I had some very naive assumptions about how the people that live in that part of Russia would react to tigers. I just assumed that perhaps they didn't care about tigers, that they were kind of ambivalent about having tigers. But when I got over there, what I found was the people that live in these regions where these tigers are found are very respectful of the tigers. They like having tigers in their area.
Hmm.
It's a symbol of their heritage. It's a symbol of the wild, which they are very, very integrated. Their lifestyle is very, very integrated with the wild in terms of it's not very developed in that area where you'll see tigers. So they're much more dependent on the land.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this tremendous respect and almost reverence for tigers. When you talk to the people that live in the villages, they want to have tigers. They don't necessarily want to see them, but they don't mind that they're there.
Hmm. And there was a particular couple you worked with who've done a lot for conservation. How did you find them, and what did they tell you that's useful for you back here?
Sure. Dr. Linda Curley is an American-born conservation biologist who has dedicated her life to the conservation and recovery of Amur tigers. And she works along with her husband, Misha Boroshenko, who is a native Russian. They live in the Russian Far East, and they actually are sponsored by the Zoo Society of London. And so I've got in contact with them through some of my colleagues. And Dr. Curley and Misha have been studying tigers for nearly 20 years in Russia.
Hmm.
And they've been looking at this one particular state reserve and monitoring the tiger population there, working with the local officials very effectively at education programs about tigers, learning as much as they can about the habitat and the needs of those animals, with a long-term goal of obviously maintaining and growing a very viable population of tigers. Fantastic people, made a lot of sacrifices in their lives in order to be able to do this fantastic work.
In interacting with the tigers here at the Indianapolis Zoo, what are some of your favorite moments? What do you like to watch them do?
Well, what's really neat about our new exhibit, the Tiger Forest, presented by Citizens Energy Group, is the fact that you will be able to get within inches of a tiger. Now, if you contrast that to Dr. Curley's work in Russia, she's been there almost 20 years. She's actually only seen a live tiger about a dozen times.
Wow.
So she has not had nearly as a robust of an experience. and getting up close and personal with those tigers, as you will be able to have at our new exhibit, separated by just an inch and a half of glass from a tiger. You'll be able to see their whiskers. You'll be able to look right into those animals' eyes. And when I was out at the exhibit yesterday, our cats are wonderful. They're coming right up to that glass where they can, so you'll be able to see them. You'll be able to get an idea of how big they are and how magnificent they really look.
Sharon Gamble with Nora Fletchell, VP of Conservation for the Indianapolis Zoo. See the Emir tigers in the Tiger Forest habitat. For more information, visit IndianapolisZoo.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The Children's Museum of Indianapolis opened a new exhibit in June called National Geographic Treasures of the Earth. Well, actually, it's three new exhibits, including an Egyptian tomb, a pirate shipwreck, and some ancient Chinese warriors. Travis DiNicola spoke with the museum's president and CEO, Jeffrey Patchen, about this new permanent exhibit and partnership.
Jeff, welcome to our studio. It's great to see you here in person today. I think the last time we talked was by phone, and you were on a boat on the Nile.
2 years ago.
Two years ago.
We were scheduled to go to take a group, our second group of family, family travelers over to Egypt on March 27th, but obviously of this year. But obviously that was canceled due to all the unrest there.
Things have changed a bit.
Yeah, they certainly have.
Well, you have, so 2 years ago, you were on the Nile, and we were chatting about this very exhibit that's going to be opening in June. This has got to be so exciting. I know you've been working on the National Geographic exhibit in partnership for quite a while. Where would you like to start in talking
about it?
Well,
you know, the partnership with National Geographic has just been just the best to partner with. The relationship goes back almost 7 years when we conceived of an exhibit about maps, because kids and families need to know where they are and where we've come from and all of that. So we developed this traveling exhibit called National Geographic Maps, Tools for Adventure. And part of what National Geographic contributed was a focus on six National Geographic explorers, of which Dr. Zahi Hawass, who's chair of the Supreme Council of Antiquities in Egypt, was one, and led us to a whole series of relationships related to everything from helping to design a new children's museum in Cairo to the content for this exhibit, which focuses on this incredible tomb of the Pharaoh Seti I, one of the most beautiful and glorious tombs in the Valley of the Kings. And it's just, of course, National Geographic is that incredible treasure trove of photography and images of the world.
Now, you know, of course, this is incredibly educational, and kids are going to love it. But I must say, I mean, it seems like more of the type of an exhibit that, you know, a history museum or a science museum or, you know, or even the Metropolitan Museum of Art would have, as opposed to a children's museum.
Well, thank you for recognizing that. We work very hard at an approach that we call family learning. That even though our name is the Children's Museum of Indianapolis, there is just as much for adults as there is for children. And necessarily when we create these large permanent spaces, like we are with National Geographic, we want to engage the entire family. And so there'll be lots of information and activities for adults as well as, of course, for children and youth.
Very good. Now, and this is a permanent exhibit,
not
just a traveling or touring or temporary piece. Where in the Children's Museum is it going to be physically located?
This will be actually in two levels. The lower level, and our visitors may and friends may remember a gallery called What If that actually had a mummy in it for a long period of time and some dinosaurs and underwater kind of thing. And the level just above that, in level one, which we've created kind of an overlook into the gallery space, and a special new elevator, new lift, that will actually take visitors from the second floor down to the lower level in a kind of a themed descent experience.
Okay, and this is on the right. Is that correct? When you walk into the
lobby?
Yes,
it
is. Okay, I'm just trying to sort of picture where it all is. Now there's three major exhibits that are part of the National Geographic Treasures of the Earth. Tell me a little bit about each one, if you would.
Well, we wanted to cover the idea was archaeology, and we know from Dinosphere that kids just love paleontology and they love digging and all of that kind of thing. And everybody kind of has these mysteries around legendary fiction and sometimes nonfiction characters like
Indiana Jones.
Right. And Quest for Things Unfound and the Mysteries of the Past. And so we really wanted to spend some time delving into archaeology. And so we selected three three incredible excavations, even though they were discovered in the two of them discovered quite a while ago in the past, are revealing new science. In the case of the tomb of Seti I, there's new information about a shaft leading into this tomb. And so visitors will have an opportunity to figure out where does that shaft lead and what are the clues along the way that might tell us about whose tomb is at the end. The second is the Terracotta Warriors of Xi'an, which were discovered in the mid-70s by a farmer digging for water for a well, and discovered these thousands of terracotta soldiers from the Emperor Qin dynasty. And, of course, the new science there is that they've discovered that these were not plain gray brown figures as we've come to see them in all the pictures, but they were very brightly painted from some new research about the chemicals that have been discovered.
And each one's completely different.
Each one has some features that are unique and different, mostly the facial features. And there were even some variations in the paint, which are very interesting. And then the third is a more recent find by underwater archaeologist right here in our own state, Professor Charlie Beaker from Indiana University, who found the shipwreck of Captain Kidd the pirate in 10 feet of water in the Dominican Republic, and is turning that excavation site into an underwater park, which we are dedicating next week with Charlie in the Dominican Republic. It's very exciting.
Now on that one, how does something in 10 feet of water go undiscovered for so long?
Well, it's an interesting story. It is actually 20 minutes away from the coast of the Dominican Republic on a just literally 10 or 15 feet off a coral shelf, which is on a little tiny island called Catalina. It's not the Catalina in California. Mm-hmm. It's the Catalina off the coast of the Dominican Republic. And what happened was that Kidd's ship was offloaded on the mainland, set ablaze, left the cannon in it, and it sailed across on its own until it bumped into this island of Catalina and sank ablaze. Mm-hmm. And the cannon just remained in this pile. And, of course, over the years, it was 1699, I think, when it sank. Over the years, became encrusted with coral and the like. And then a local diver found it and reported it. And the government, along with Charlie, kind of...
Eventually, they sort of realized what it was.
And Charlie's been able to confirm the kid that was Kidd's ship because he found some teak wood at the site, and the teak wood was joined in a way called a rabbit joint that he had never seen before, and there was only one shipbuilder in that time period in India, and he traced this back to. Various historical journals, et cetera, to a family that was building teak ships in that particular time period in India. He traveled over to India.
Wow.
The same family is in the business.
Still.
It has the records of that family business today.
Huh.
It's just magic of the past that, you know, you never know where the mysteries are and how close to human history today the past is.
Yeah, wow, that's just fascinating. Now, with the Kidd ship, you'll have on display the cannon, is that
correct? We have it on display. Okay. We will have it on display. It's in the museum now in a very special large tank, and we'll now be one of the three sites for conservation of artifacts from the Dominican Republic. There's a wet lab that the Dominican Republic government has. There's one that Charlie has at IU. And now we'll be the third to have a functioning wet lab, which will begin to expose these pieces by removing all of the incrustation and barnacles and corals and all of that.
Right. So it's in water.
It's in fresh water with a chemical process and electricity called electrolytic reduction.
Wow.
And over that over a time period of about 2 years, our visitors will be able to see this cannon shape becoming clearer and clearer.
How neat.
Matter of fact, Charlie's had it, I think, for almost 8 months or a year now, and there is an insignia that has revealed itself on the side of the cannon, which, again, further confirms where it was made, et cetera, et cetera. So
excellent.
It's very exciting.
That's very cool. I mean, reasons certainly to keep going back and seeing how that
absolutely
evolves.
And we just received this incredible grant from the Lilly Company Foundation for a series of additional expeditions for the Kara Merchant for Kidship, one for a 1725 Spanish galleon that Charlie has found called the Begonia, which was found in 3 feet of sand and water, not far from the runway at the Santo Domingo Airport. And the third ship he's looking for, and he believes he has some strong indication of maybe present, is one of the lost fleet of Columbus.
Wow.
Which is just so exciting.
Hey, Jeff,
to have
a children's
museum engaged in this with National Geographic and Charlie just makes this all come alive for children and families.
I mean, did you ever imagine when you got into the business of children's museums that you'd be doing this type of work? I mean, this is...
Oh, no. Yeah. This is what... And I think most of the staff in the museum and the board and volunteers as well, we think the best stories are are true ones, and so that's why we promote real humanities, real arts, real sciences, and trying to bring the real stories of the past to life for children and families versus fictional kinds of things.
So. Now I did mention, of course, that the cannon is a real artifact.
It is.
I do want to be clear that with the Terracotta Warriors, these are recreations.
These are replicas, right?
Replicas, okay. And and then there's sort of a combination of both with the Tomb of Seti?
Absolutely. We have some objects from Seti's tomb. We have some Shabtis and some other small pieces on loan from the British Museum and a number of other locations that will be on display and then rotated out and other objects brought in of that particular time period. We're working hard with the Shaanxi Regional Provincial Government in Xi'an to bring some real Terracotta Warriors here in the future, which we think will be very exciting as well.
Wow, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
How very neat. Congratulations on
Thank
all
you.
This. Yeah, it's just great stuff, which leads me to a question that a friend of mine asked me the other day. And he said, I love the Children's Museum, but do you think they would ever consider having an adults-only night just to for all the adults who want to see this stuff, who maybe don't have kids, who don't want to...
Well, it's funny when we do tours for adults and they say, this place would be a lot of fun if there just weren't so many kids around. And we kind of laugh, but...
Of course.
We do have, of course, behind the scenes and some tours and things like that for adults. But that's a good idea, Travis. We need to take back and see if maybe once in a while we could do an adults-only evening or something like that.
Or maybe a rent-a-kid thing for,
there
for
you
those
go.
Of us who don't have kids.
There
you want to, takes some there. Now, of course, Jeff, while I got you here, just briefly, you've got a lot of other great exhibits there, fun things going on this summer. Anything else you'd like to share with us?
It'll be an exciting summer with National Geographic. It opens June 11th. Mm-hmm. There's a gala on June 4th for anyone that would like to attend. Just let the museum know. And in the fall, we're bringing in a very exciting exhibit called Frogs.
Okay.
Which is hundreds of live frogs
and
a frog handler with them. From the smallest little tiny tree frog to the big cane toads. And it's very, very exciting. And then, of course, the haunted house.
Of course.
Which is always, always fun. Mm-hmm. And then Jolly Days, which follows that as
well. Sure, of course. And all the other great things, the Big Chihuly piece.
And we still have Dora and Diego. Mm-hmm. That's a traveling exhibit that we put together with Nickelodeon that will be here for a bit longer, and then we'll go on tour.
Very good. Jeff, a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you, Travis.
Again, congratulations on these great exhibits. I can't wait to see them.
Travis DiNicola with Jeffrey Patchen, President and CEO of the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. The exhibit National Geographic Treasures of the Earth is open now. More information is at childrensmuseum.org. Hey, Travis, what's your favorite color?
Let's see, blue?
Oh, I love the blue ones. Look over there.
Oh!
Ooh,
You know, blue fireworks are actually some of the hardest ones to make.
I've heard that.
Yeah, I remember hearing that from George Plimpton, who actually wrote a book on fireworks along with everything else he's ever done. Anyway, something you might want to check out this weekend. But we've got some other ideas of ways to celebrate with fireworks or without on
What Do We Do? The Independence Day weekend edition.
There you
go. Well, actually, don't forget the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra is doing its big Symphony on the Prairie patriotic pops concerts all weekend. You can go to indianapolissymphony.org to get the details, but one of the best attended events of the entire year. And don't forget fireworks and cannon and patriotic music and all the good stuff.
And that's going to be totally awesome. If for some reason you decide you don't want to go outside on the 4th, then may I recommend watching the Indianapolis Symphony Principal Pops Conductor Jack Everly, who is going to be conducting the nationally televised A Capital 4th on July 4th. Here on WFYI TV, that is, and that is going to be from 8 to 9:30, and Jack is going to be in D.C. conducting that orchestra, and how cool is that?
Woohoo! He's everywhere. You know, we don't appreciate him as much as we should. He's got a national and even international profile.
That's pretty awesome.
If you're hearing us on Friday night, you still have time to go out, and there might still be a little wine left at all the galleries around on First Friday.
Of course.
You can also pop over to the Frank and Katrina Basile Gallery at Heron School of Art and see works by the Dean of Heron School of Art and Design, Valerie Eichmeier, up right now.
That's a very cool show. Mm-hmm. Hey, something to think about doing on July 4th during the day before the fireworks is the annual ice cream social that is held at the President Benjamin Harrison home. And this year, in addition to the ice cream social that they have, they're also they've got a lot of other fun things going on, including circus-themed entertainers, including stilt walkers and live music from the White River Jazz Band. There's crafts and face painting and Victorian games. You can walk through the house, and there's all sorts of other cool things going on, as well as, of course, the ice cream and some pork barbecue sandwiches and hot dogs and cotton candy. And I just can't wait. When are we going? So again, that is from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Monday, July 4th at the President Benjamin Harrison home.
Very good. If you happen to be looking for something to do in Carmel, don't forget Carmel Fest this Sunday. You can hear Carmel Brass at 3:45. You hear more about Carmel Brass elsewhere on our program, but this Sunday, you can hear them at 3:45 at Carmel Fest, a wonderful patriotic celebration.
Very cool. And one thing I do want to mention that going on this weekend is the free inaugural rock and roll barbecue that's taking place in the parking lot of Victory Field. Not in Victory Field, in the West parking lot. And it is going on July 1st through the 3rd and includes the Charlie Daniels Band and Puddle of Mud and Soul Asylum and Gin Blossom and Loverboy and all types of great bands that are playing every day. And then there's lots of barbecue. You do have to pay for the barbecue, of course.
It's as American as baseball, hot dogs, and barbecue and rock and roll.
In a parking lot.
In a parking lot.
It's like a big tailgate.
If you're looking for patriotic tunes on July 4th, that's Monday, go hear the Indianapolis Municipal Band play patriotic tunes, especially marches, and I know Seuss is going to turn up on that program, at Concerts on the Canal at the Indiana History Center.
How fun. Something else to do on the 4th, the Canal Family Fest on July 4th, where you can celebrate America at the Idle Jorg Museum. Admission to the museum is free from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on July 4th. And at 4:30, there's a whole bunch of family-friendly games, music, crafts, artist demonstrations, and they've also got a barbecue buffet. More barbecue going on at the Canal Family Fest at the Idle Jorg. Never enough barbecue.
Wait. Barbecue's not even an American invention.
Oh, sure it is.
No.
Well, we just perfected
we tweaked it.
That's what
there
it
we
was.
Go. You know, we have lots more things going on, but I fear that we're out of time. So be careful out there. Don't play with fireworks. Stick to the sparklers.
That's very good advice.
The professionals do their job.
Excellent advice. You know what? I do want to mention one more thing before we go.
What is it?
And set off some Roman candles. That is that if you've not had a chance to see Avenue Q at the Phoenix Theater, they have just added three performances, and they are coming up on the weekend of July 15th through the 17th. Three more performances of Avenue Q at the Phoenix Theater. How fun. So do that and be safe with your fireworks.
Very good. And we'll see you next week on
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
So you think quilts were invented strictly out of necessity, don't you? Well, Sharon Gamble discovered quilting traditions run the gamut from elegant to instructional, and you can see the whole spectrum in frugal and fancy Indiana quilts on view at the Indiana State Museum through July 17th. The ISM's Mary Jane Teeters Eichhiker, curator of social history, and Kathy Moore, communications director, brought some quilts with them for this conversation.
So in this exhibition, two different schools of quilting? Would schools be the right way to describe them, Mary Jane?
Styles, perhaps,
styles.
Sharon.
They kind of came together, and which one was frugal and which one was fancy, and where did they come from?
Well, of course, American immigrants brought their culture with them from Europe. And the fancy style was an upper-class style that you did if you were wealthy and could afford the elaborate fabrics or the elaborate workmanship, and that mostly was a British Isles production. In which they would use either whole cloth, in which the pattern was entirely done in the stitches, and these were often silk quilts or glazed wool, often done by professional male quilters, or they would use an applique design based on buying a couple of yards of very, very expensive imported Indian floral chintz. And this was a point at which European printers could not reproduce all the colors and designs and things that could be done by East Indian craftspeople. That fabric was imported. They would buy a couple of yards, and then to make it fit a whole bed, you would cut out the motifs and rearrange them, applique them on a plain background, and it was a style called, it was a chintz applique style. There is an example of that in the exhibit. It's just the centerpiece of a quilt that was never finished, but it shows that very elaborate style that was really practiced only by people wealthy enough to spend a lot of money on a couple of yards of imported goods.
And even those people are pretty inventive about stretching that very expensive fabric.
They really were. I mean, if you were really wealthy, I guess you could have bought the yardage and made everything out of the yardage. But boy, that was putting on not one dog but two or three.
How does quilting relate to embroidery or needlepoint? Are they related at all?
Well, the same people did most of those things if they were upper class. Needlework was intended and thought of as something that upper class women should fill their time with, since our brains were too weak to indulge in mathematics and languages and business and so forth.
Wait, I have to pause you right there, because anybody who's ever quilted knows how much math is involved and how much engineering. Let's see, creativity, of course, but wow, what a misconception. Yeah.
But education and the view of women was very, very different in the 19th and 18th centuries than it is today.
I have this perception, and it might be completely false, and it's probably from some costume drama movie I saw somewhere, that the wealthier and more privileged you were, the tinier your quilting stitches would be, the finer your hand and your motor coordination would be, that was a sign of breeding somehow. Is there any validity to that?
Well, only peripherally. You often were sent to needlework schools that taught you those fine hand skills. Those were not free, and so you had to have enough money to educate your daughters. It was another indication of the amount of time you could spend doing that. If you were ordinary person, you had your impetus was more to make warm covers for your family, and you might be in a hurry, especially if you had 12 children to get bed covers for.
Sure, sure.
So that's where that more frugal style comes in. Came largely from the Scots-Irish, who had this piecework tradition or strip quilt tradition.
And was that about recycling fabric and not wasting it? Was it what the popular conception is, which is my six-year-old has outgrown her dress mm-hmm. and there's no younger daughter to pass it on to, but I like this fabric, so I'm going to put it in a quilt?
Sometimes that was true, particularly later after the 1830s or so, after the Industrial Revolution made all that manufactured fabric cheap enough to have access to. And then you were using that fabric, the printed and the striped and the patterned fabrics. Then you had that available. And you didn't waste that stuff. And you might, you know, anybody who sews knows that there are offcuts. So you might, rather than making your quilt out of half-worn fabrics, unless it was a real utility piece, you would use those offcuts and be brand new fabric. It would simply be that you were using those little leftover parts, and you'd already paid for them by when you bought the fabric for the clothing. But the earliest quilts, people have the idea that American quilting started out as this very frugal craft. And if you were an early pioneer, the first thing you did was weave blankets. And it wasn't until that weaving tradition had really gone by the board because of the Industrial Revolution and the ability to purchase fabrics that you had that kind of scrap tradition quilt appearing. We do have in the museum an extremely rare hand-woven two-piece, it amounts to a blanket that's been quilted. And it and several others like it came from southwestern Indiana in a tradition that may have come up from the upland south. You know, I'm not quite sure what the borders of that tradition are, but it's certainly a style that would be much earlier than the pieced quilt and speaks to that weaving tradition. And then when nobody had the huge looms in their houses anymore and were not weaving that fabric, then a piecework, an applique tradition, could supplant that.
That quilt actually looks kind of like denim. From a distance, you think it's denim. And then and it's two colors. Is it black or navy? I forget. And red.
It's a dark red and a dark blue. And when you look at it, you think, because it's in a quilt
exhibit.
It's heavy.
It's very heavy. It really does look like denim until you get close. And then you realize it's wool and linen or something like that woven.
And it has only one seam. It looks as though it's pieced, but it's simply horizontal stripes, and it has a center seam. Yeah. And so it is, in essence, a blanket.
And very warm.
Very warm. Back to the fancy quilts for a moment. These quilts that these upper-class ladies of all ages were making, were they actually used, or were they decorative?
They were used. Who knows how many were originally made? Mm-hmm. Not that many survive because they were used. They were also, you're very right, for show. And if it was only to keep warm, you could have used, you know, almost anything. But in the early period of quilting, beds were found in the best parlors. It was simply you had a different way of organizing your house. And your best room might contain your best bed and your other best furnishings, and that's where you entertained. So you wanted something that was really nice to show off, and you would use it. But it was also a way to attain status.
Weren't they also for special occasions, too, though? So they might have shown it because it was a wedding gift or
Later on, like in the mid-19th century, you had those beautiful red and green applique quilts, of which we have two gorgeous examples in the exhibit. And they might be put on the bed only for a special occasion. You know, we're kind of conflating several time periods here.
Lot of labor to just bring something out once or twice a year, if you think about that. Wow. It's like using your grandmother's china only once a year.
That's what, to me, is so interesting about the show, because I am... I'm someone who does some crafts. I'm not all that. I'm a little too ADD to sit down and do it forever like that. But to, you know, I think that even if you have no crafting at all in your background, you can look at those quilts and just have such, you're just in awe of the work that goes behind those. And, you know, the months that they must have spent, some of them by candlelight, doing all this hand stitching. It's just, it's unbelievable how much work went into it and how perfect it can be. You know, a quilt that has tiny little half-inch squares that, you know, if you cut it an eighth of an inch off, it's not going to work.
Right.
That's the math that you said before.
Right.
You know, they have to be perfect in their cutting. They also have to be perfect in their stitching so that it'll come out right. So I think that people, even if you're not interested in quilting, you still would have an appreciation for seeing
Absolutely.
These things in this show.
How many are in the museum's collection, and then how many of those are in this exhibition?
There are over 700 quilts in the museum's collection.
Wow.
And it's a collection we're actively building because it's a very important part of Indiana's tradition. There are 33 quilts in the show. There are 24 full-sized, four wall quilts, and then a crib quilt and four doll quilts.
And
so they're all sizes.
You've brought a couple of the doll quilts, and I'd like you to describe them. Let's start chronologically with the older
sure.
of the two.
The first one I have here is a navy blue and white single Irish chain, and it's the blocks are miniaturized, so it looks like a miniature of a full-sized quilt. The navy blue blocks are printed with these tiny little white stars, and it's quilted every half inch or so all the way across the piece, and bound in fabric that's exactly the same. It's probably from the 1870s.
And it's about 2 feet by a little more than
yeah,
24
I'd
by 30-ish?
I'd say about 24, 26 by 14 or so.
Mm-hmm. And would a doll quilt be a natural project for a daughter to have her mother teach her how to quilt? That would be her first project, maybe?
That's often what it was. This one looks like it was either a more expert sewer, or the mother,
mm-hmm.
possibly an older sister doing it for the mm-hmm. child. But that's frequently how a child was taught to sew because, of course, then she had, and I say she because it usually was a girl.
Sure.
Although boys were taught to quilt, especially if they were sick in bed a lot or if they were, there are a lot of wonderful quilts by Civil War veterans who made them as they were recuperating.
Hmm.
So it wasn't always a women's craft.
Speaking of the Civil War, the sewing machine came into wide distribution about when?
Late 1850s, 1860s. They finally got many of the kinks worked out. It was one of those things that took about 50 years to finally get it to work right.
Hmm.
And then when Isaac Singer got into the picture shortly after the Civil War, he really developed the marketing that allowed everybody to have a sewing machine by payment plan or one of the many other, or joining a sewing club, and you know, 10 women got together and bought one machine and shared it around.
Hmm.
So after pretty much after the Civil War, you start seeing the machine used for either the piecing or even the quilting, because of course at that point it was a status symbol to have the machine, and you wanted that machine stitching to show.
This the newer of the two doll quilts you've brought, though, is still hand stitched, right?
It's still hand stitched. It's a very small 1920s quilt. It's an album, the album cross pattern in a blue print and white. And right across the center has been embroidered in a darker blue, the name Patty. And we know the family this one came from. It was a German family, the Schocks, on the south side of Indianapolis, made either by the mother or by one of the three daughters. And we think Patty was the name of one of their dolls.
Aw. And lest people think that quilting hasn't become quite modern. There's a really cool quilt in the exhibit that you essentially, I don't know if commissioned is the right word, but requested from a friend. And I want you to tell us about the QR code quilt. This cracks me up that you would even think to do this.
This is so cool. QR codes are appearing on a lot of products now, and you can, if your smartphone has, if you download the QR code app, you can click on those different codes and sometimes get recipes, sometimes see more information about the product. We thought this would be a great way to give a little more information to the visitor. So I asked Sherry McConnell of Anderson, Indiana, to make us a QR code quilt. It's black and white, squares and rectangles. It's hanging in the exhibit, and if you focus on that quilt, you will be led to a video that we have made showing how the exhibit Frugal and Fancy was put together as it's hanging within the exhibit.
And it was a little nervous-making for Sherry as she was making it because these codes are really precise. That's why they're normally printed on paper.
Right. This is only the second QR code in fabric we've ever heard of. And she was quite concerned that it was actually going to work. And then we were quite concerned because there was a little, an extra step in the posting of the video that we didn't know about. So at first it worked and then it didn't. So everybody started chewing fingernails for a little bit. But it worked magnificently. And it was machine quilted to help it stay flat and so that it would read better by Deb Geyer, who's also in Anderson. And of course, we asked them to do that right around Christmas time.
Nobody has they didn't have anything else.
No stress
else
or anything.
They didn't have 10 other Christmas projects they were trying to sew.
Of course not.
Sharon Gamble with the Indiana State Museum's Mary Jane Teeters-Eichacker, Curator of Social History, and Kathy Moore, Communications Director. You can see quilts, including the QR code quilt in the exhibit Frugal and Fancy Indiana Quilts, through July 17th at the Indiana State Museum. Learn more at indianamuseum.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4, when I'll find out about the World Championships of Comedy Sports.
How funny. I'll tune in the Carmel Brass.
And I'll get a preview of the show The Andrews Brothers at the Actors Theater of Indiana. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.